This is Rachel, recording for Radio Talking Book Network in Omaha, Nebraska. I will be reading Bookshelf, starting with Part 14 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. My friends of the thirst and the language that was of bloom and blood laughed, as they told me how the captain's swears exceeded even his usual polyglot, and was more than ever full of picturesque, when on questioning other mariners who were on movement up and down on the river that hour, he found that a few of them had seen any fog at all, except where it lay round the wharf. However, the ship went out on the ebb tide, and was doubtless by morning far down the river mouth. She was by then, when they told us, well out to sea. And so, dear Madam Mina, it is that we have to rest for a time, for our enemy is on the sea, with the fog as his command, on his way to the Danube mouth. To sail a ship takes time. Go she never so quick. And when we start, we go on land more quick, and we meet him there. Our best hope is to come to him when in the box, between sunrise and sunset, for then he can make no struggle, and we may deal with him as we should. There are days for us in which we can make ready our plan. We know all about where he go, for we have seen the owner of the ship, who has shown us our invoices and all papers that can be. The box we seek is to be landed in Varna, and to be given to an agent, one Ristix, who will be there to present his credentials, and so our merchant friend will have done his part. When he asks if there be any wrong, for that is so, he can telegraph and have inquiry made at Varna. We say no, for what is to be done is not police or of the customs. It must be done by us alone, and in our own way. When Dr. Van Helsing had done speaking, I asked him if it were certain that the Count had remained on board the ship. He replied, "We have the best proof of that, your own evidence, when in the hypnotic trance this morning." I asked him again if it were really necessary that they should pursue the Count, for, oh, I dread Jonathan leaving me, and I know that he would surely go if the others went. He answered in growing passion, at first quietly. As he went on, however, he grew more angry and more forceful, till in the end we could not but see wherein there was at least some of that personal dominance that made him so long a master amongst men. Yes, it is necessary. 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 For your sake in the first, and then for the sake of humanity. This monster has done much harm already, in the narrow scope where he find himself, and in the short time when as yet he was only as a body groping his so small measure in darkness and not knowing. All this have I told these others. You, my dear Madam Mina, will learn it in the phonograph of my friend John, or in that of your husband. I have told them how the measure of leaving his own barren land, barons of peoples, and coming to a new land, where life of man teems like there a multitude of standing corn, was the work of centuries. Were another of the undead, like him, to try to do what he has done, perhaps not all the centuries of the world that have been or would be could aid him. But this one, all the forces of nature that are occult and deep and strong must have worked together in some wondrous way. The very place where he have been alive, undead for all these centuries, is full of strangeness in the geologic and chemical world. There are deep caverns and fissures that reach none know whither. There have been volcanoes, some of whose openings still send out waters of strange properties and gases that kill or make to vivify. Doubtless there is something magnetic or electric in these combinations of occult forces which work for physical life in strange way, and in himself were from the first great some great qualities. It is a hard and warlike time he was celebrate that he have more iron nerve, more subtle brain, more braver heart than any man. In him some vital principle have in strange way found their utmost, and as his body keep strong and grow and thrive, so his brain grow too. All this without that diabolic aid which is surely to him, for it hath to yield the powers that it come from, and are symbolic of good. And now this is what he is to us. He have infect you. Oh, forgive me, my dear, that I must say such, but it is for good of you that I speak. He infect you in such wise that even if he do no more, you have only to live, to live in your own sweet way, and so in time death, which is of man's common lot and with God's sanction, shall make you like to him. This cannot be. We have sworn together that it is not. Thus, we are ministers of God's own wish, that the world and the men from whom his son die will not be given over to monsters whose very existence would defame him. He has allowed us to redeem one soul already, and we go out as the old knights of the cross to redeem more. Like them, we shall travel towards the sunrise, and like them, if we fall in good cause. He paused, and I said, But will the Count not take his rebuff wisely? Since he has been driven from England, will he not avoid it, as a tiger does the village from which he has been hunted? Aha, he said, your simile of the tiger good for me, and I shall adopt him. Your man-eater, as they in India call the tiger who has once tasted the blood of human, care no more for other prey, but prowl unceasing till he get him. This that we hunt from our village is a tiger too, and a man-eater, and he never cease to prowl. Nay, in himself he is not one to retire and stay afar. In his life, his living life, he go over the Turkey frontier and attack his enemy on his own ground. He be beaten back, but did he stay? No, he come again, and again, and again. Look at his persistence and endurance. With the child brain that was to him, he has long since conceived the idea of coming to a great city. What does he do? He find out the place of all the world most of promise for him. Then he deliberately set himself down to prepare for the task. He find in patience just how is his strength and what are his powers. He study new tongues. He learn new social life, new environment of old ways, the politic, the law, the finance, the science, the habit of a new land and a new people who have come to be since he was. His glimpse that he have had whet his appetite only, and in keen his desire. Nay, it help him to grow as to his brain, for it all proved to him how right he was at the first in his surmises. He have done all this alone, all alone, from a ruined tomb in a forgotten land. What more may he not do when the greater world of thought is open to him? He that can smile at death as we know him, who can flourish in the midst of diseases that kill off whole peoples. Oh, if such a one was to come from God and not the devil, what a force for good might he not be in this old world of ours. But we are pledged to set the world free. Our toil must be in silence, and our efforts all in secret. For in this enlightened age, when men believe not even what they see, the doubting of wise men would be his greatest strength. It would be at once his sheath and his armor, and his weapon to destroy us, his enemies, who are willing to peril even our own souls for the safety of one we love, for the good of mankind, and for the honor and glory of God. After a general discussion, it was determined that for tonight nothing would be definitely settled, and that we should all sleep on the facts and try to think out the proper conclusions. Tomorrow at breakfast we are to meet again, and after making some conclusions known to one another, we shall decide on some infinite course of action. I feel a wonderful peace and rest tonight. It is as if some haunting presence were removed from me. Perhaps my surmise was not finished, could not be, for I caught sight in the mirror of the red mark upon my forehead, and I knew that I was still unclean. Dr. Seward's Diary, 5th of October. We all rose early, and I think that sleep did much for each and all of us. When we met at early breakfast, there was no more general cheerfulness in any of us than we ever expected to experience again. It really is wonderful how much resilience there is in human nature. Let any obstructing cause, no matter what, be removed in any way, even by death, and we fly back to first principles of hope and enjoyment. More than once, as we sat around the table, my eyes opened in wonder whether the whole of the past days had not been a dream. It was only when I caught the sight of the red blotch on Mrs. Harker's forehead that I was brought back to reality. Even now, when I'm gravely resolving the matter, it's almost impossible to realize that the cause of all of our trouble is still existent. Even Mr. Harker seems to lose sight of his trouble for whole spells. It is only now and again, when something recalls it to Mina's mind, that she thinks of her terrible scar. We are to meet here in my study in half an hour and decide on our course of action. I see only one immediate difficulty. I know it by instinct rather than reason. We shall all have to speak frankly, and yet I fear that in some mysterious way, poor Mrs. Harker's tongue is tied. I know that she can form conclusions on her own, and from all that has been, I can guess how brilliant and true they must be. But she will not, or cannot, give them utterance. I've mentioned this to Van Helsing, and he and I are to talk it over when we are alone. I suppose it is some of that horrid poison which has gotten to her veins beginning to work. The Count has his own purposes when he gave her what Van Helsing called the vampire's baptism of blood. Well, there may be a poison that distills itself out of good things. In an age where the existence of photamines is a mystery, we should not wonder at anything. One thing I know, that if my instinct be true regarding poor Mrs. Harker's silences, then there is a terrible difficulty, an unknown danger, in the work before us. The same power that compels her silence may compel her speech. I dare not think further, for so I should in my thoughts dishonor a noble woman. Van Helsing is coming to my study a little before the others. I will try to open the subject with him. Later. When the professor came in, we talked over the state of things. I could see that he had something on his mind which he wanted to say, but felt some hesitancy about broaching the subject. After beating about the bush a little, he said suddenly, "Friend John, there is something that you and I must talk of alone, just at the first, at any rate. Later, we may have to take the others into our confidence." He stopped, so I waited. He went on. "Madam Mina, our poor Madam Mina is changing." A cold shiver ran through me to find my worst fears thus endorsed. Van Helsing continued. "With the sad experience of Miss Lucy, we must this time be warned before things go too far. Our task is now in reality more difficult than ever, and this new trouble makes every hour of the direst importance. I can see the characteristics of the vampire coming into her face. It is now but very, very slight, but it is to be seen if we have eyes to notice without to prejudge. Her teeth are some sharper, and at times her eyes are more hard. But these are not all. There is to her the silence now, often, as it was so with Miss Lucy. She did not speak, even when she wrote that she wished to be known later. Now my fear is this, if it be that she can, by our hypnotic trance, tell what the Count see and hear, is it not more true that he who have hypnotized her first, and who have drink of her very blood and make her drink of his, should, if he will, compel her mind to disclose to him that which she know?" I nodded acquiescence. He went on. "Then, what we must do is to prevent this. We must keep her ignorant of our intent, so she cannot tell what she know not. This is a painful task. Oh, so painful that it heartbreak me to think of, but it must be. When today we meet, I must tell her that for a reason which we will not speak, she must not more be of our counsel, but be simply guarded by us." He wiped his forehead, which had broken out in profuse perspiration at the thought of the pain which he might have to inflict on the poor soul already so tortured. I knew that it would be some sort of comfort to him if I told him that I had also come to the same conclusion, for at any rate, it would take away the pain of doubt. I told him, and the effect was as expected. It is now close to the time of our general gathering. Van Helsing has gone away to prepare for the meeting, and his painful part of it. I really believe his purpose is to be able to pray alone. Later. At the very outset of our meeting, a great personal relief was experienced by both Van Helsing and myself. Mrs. Harker had sent a message to her husband to say that she would not join us at present, as she thought it would be better that we should be free to discuss our movements without her presence to embarrass us. The professor and I looked at each other for an instant, and somehow we both seemed relieved. For my own part, I thought that if Mrs. Harker realized the danger herself, it was much pain as well as much danger averted. Under the circumstances, we agreed, by a questioning look and answer, with finger on lip to preserve silence of our suspicions, until we should have been able to confer alone again. We went at once into the plan of our campaign. Van Helsing roughly put the facts before us first. The Tsarina Catherine left the Thames yesterday morning. It will take her, at the quickest speed she has ever made, at least 3 weeks to reach Varna. But we can travel overland in the same place in 3 days. Now, if we allow for 2 days less for the ship's voyage, owing to such weather influences as we know the Count can bring to bear, and if we allow a whole day and night for any delays which may occur to us, then we have a margin of nearly 2 weeks. Thus, in order to be quite safe, we must leave here on the 17th at the latest. Then we shall be at any rate in Varna a day before the ship arrives and able to make such preparations as be necessary. Of course, we shall all go armed against evil things, spiritual as well as physical. Here Quincy Morris added, I understand that the Count comes from a wolf country, and it may be that he hath get there before us. I propose that we add Winchesters to our armament. I have a kind of belief in a Winchester when there's any trouble of that sort around. You remember, Art, when we had that pack after us in Tobolsk? What we wouldn't have given then for a repeater apiece.
Good, said Van Helsing. Winchesters it shall be. Quincy's head is level at times, but must so when there is to hunt, though my metaphor be more dishonor than science to wolves be of danger to man. In the meantime we can do nothing here, and as I think that Varna is not familiar to any of us, why not go there more soon? It is as long to wait here as there. Tonight and tomorrow we make ready, and then, if all be well, we four can set out on our journey.
We four? Said Harker, interrogatively, looking from one to another of us.
Of course, answered the professor quickly. You must remain to take care of your sweet wife.
Harker was silent for a while, and then said, in a hollow voice, Let us talk of that part of it in the morning. I wish to consult with Mina. I thought that now was the time for Van Helsing to warn him not to disclose our plans to her, but he took no notice. I looked at him significantly and coughed. For answer, he put his finger on his lip and turned away. Jonathan Harker's Journal, 5th of October, afternoon. For some time after our meeting this morning, I could not think. The new phases of things leave my mind in a state of wonder, which allows not room for active thought. Mina's determination not to take any part of the discussion set me thinking, and as I could not argue the matter with her, I could only guess. I am as far as ever from a solution now. The way the others received it, too, puzzled me. The last time we talked of the subject, we agreed that there was to be no more concealment of anything between us. Mina is sleeping now, calmly and sweetly, like a little child. Her lips are curved, and her face beams with happiness. Thank God there are still such moments for her.
Later. How strange it all is. I sat watching Mina's happy sleep, and came as near to being happy myself as I suppose I shall ever be. As the evening drew on, and the earth took its shadows from the sun sinking lower, the silence of the room grew more and more solemn to me. All at once, Mina opened her eyes and, looking at me tenderly, said,
Jonathan, I want you to promise me something on your word of honor, a promise made to me, but made holily in God's hearing, and not to be broken, though I should go down on my knees and implore you with bitter tears. Quick, you must make it to me at once.
Mina, I said, a promise like that I cannot make at once. I may have no right to make it.
But, dear one, she said, with such spiritual intensity that her eyes were like pole stars, it is I who wish it, and it is not for myself. You can ask Van Helsing, if I'm all not right. If he disagrees, you may do as you will. Nay, more, if you all agree, later, you are absolved from the promise.
I promise, I said. And for a moment she looked supremely happy, though to me all happiness for her was denied by the red scar on her forehead. She said,
Promise me you will not tell me anything of the plans formed for the campaign against the Count, not by word or inference or implication, not at any time, whilst this remains in me. She solemnly pointed to the scar. I saw that she was in earnest and said solemnly, I promise. And as I said it, I felt that from that instant a door had been shut between us. Later, midnight. Mina has been bright and cheerful all the evening, so much so that all the rest seemed to take courage, as if infected somewhat with her gaiety, and as a result even I myself felt as if the pall of gloom which weighs us down was somewhat lifted. We all retired early. Mina's now sleeping like a little child. It is a wonderful thing that her faculty of sleep remains to her in the midst of her terrible trouble. Thank God for it, for then at least she can forget her care. Perhaps her example may affect me as her gaiety did tonight. I shall try it. Oh, for a dreamless sleep. 6th of October, morning. Another surprise. Mina woke me early, about the same time as yesterday, and asked me to bring Dr. Van Helsing. I thought it was another occasion for hypnotism, and without question went for the professor. He had evidently expected some such call, for I found him dressed in his room. His door was ajar so that he could hear the opening of the door to our room. He came at once, and as he passed into the room, he asked Mina if the others might come too. "No," she said quite simply. "It will not be necessary. You can tell them just as well. I must go with you on your journey." Dr. Van Helsing was just as startled as I was. After a moment's pause, he asked, "But why?" "You must take me with you. I'm safer with you, and you shall be safer too." "But why, dear Madam Mina? You know that your safety is our solemnest duty. We go into danger, to which you are, or may be, more liable than any of us from circumstances, things that have been." He paused, embarrassed. As she replied, she raised her finger and pointed to her forehead. "I know. That is why I must go. I can tell you now, whilst the sun is coming up, I may not be able again. I know that when the Count wills me, I must go. I know that if he tells me to come in secret, I must come by wile, by any device, to hoodwink. Even Jonathan." God saw the look that she turned on me as she spoke, and if there be indeed a recording angel, that look is noted to her everlasting honor. I could only clasp her hand. I could not speak. My emotion was too great, even for the relief of tears. She went on. "You men are brave and strong. You are strong in your numbers, for you can defy that which would break down the human endurance of one who had to guard alone. Besides, I may be of service, since you can hypnotize me and so learn that which even I myself do not know." Dr. Van Helsing said very gravely, "Madam Mina, you are, as always, most wise. You shall with us come, and together we shall do that which we go forth to achieve." When he had spoken, Mina's long spell of silence made me look at her. She had fallen back on her pillow asleep. She did not even wake when I pulled up the blind and let in the sunlight which flooded the room. Van Helsing motioned to me to come to him quietly. We went to his room, and within a minute Lord Godalming, Dr. Seward, and Mr. Morris were there with us also. He told them what Mina had said, and went on. "In the morning, we shall leave for Varna. We have now to deal with a new factor, Madam Mina. Oh, but her soul is true. It is to her agony to tell us so much as she has done. But it is most right, and we are warned in time. There must be no chance lost, and in Varna we must be ready to act the instant the ship arrives." "What shall we do, exactly?" asked Mr. Morris, laconically. The professor paused before replying. "We shall, at the first, board the ship. Then, when we've identified the box, we shall place a branch of the wild rose on it. This we shall fasten, for when there is none can emerge, so at least says the superstition. And to superstition we must trust at the first. It was man's faith in the early, and it have its root in faith still. Then, when we get the opportunity that we seek, which none are near to see, we shall open the box, and all will be well." "I shall not wait for any opportunity," said Morris. "When I see the box, I shall open it and destroy the monster, though there were 1,000 men looking on, and if I am to be wiped out for it in the next moment." I grasped his hand instinctively and found it as firm as a piece of steel. I think he understood my look. I hope he did. "Good boy," said Dr. Van Helsing. "Brave boy. Quincy is all man. God bless him for it. My child, believe me, none of us shall lag behind or pause from any fear. I do but say what we may do, what we must do. But indeed, we cannot say what we shall do. There are so many things which may happen, and their ways and their ends are so various that until the moment we may not say. We shall all be armed in all ways, and when the time for the end has come, our efforts shall not be lack. Now let us today put all of our affairs in order. Let all things what touch on others dear to us, and who on us depend, be complete. For none of us can tell what, or when, or how the end may be. As for me, my own affairs are regulate, and as I have nothing else to do, I shall go make arrangement for the travel. I shall have all tickets and so forth for our journey." There was nothing further to be said, and we parted. I shall now settle up all my affairs of earth, and be ready for whatever may come. Later. It is all done. My will is made, and all complete. Mina, if she survive, is my sole heir. If it shall not be so, then the others who have been so good to us shall have remainder. It is now drawing towards the sunset. Mina's uneasiness calls my attention to us. I'm sure there's not something on her mind which the time of the exact sunset will reveal. These occasions are becoming harrowing times for us all, for each sunrise and sunset opens up some new danger, some new pain, which, however, may in God's will mean to a good end. I write all of these things in the diary, since my darling must not hear of them now, but if may be that she can see them again, they shall be ready. She's calling to me. Dr. Seward's Diary, 11th of October, evening. Jonathan Harker has asked me to note this, as he says he's hardly equal to the task and he wants an exact record kept. I think that none of us were surprised when we asked to see Mrs. Harker a little before the time of sunset. We have, of late, come to understand that sunrise and sunset are to her times of particular freedom, where her old self can be manifest without any controlling force subduing or restraining her or inciting her to action. This mood or condition begins some half hour or more before actual sunrise or sunset, and lasts until either the sun is high or whilst the clouds are still aglow with the rays streaming above the horizon. At first there's a sort of negative condition, as if some tie were loosened, and then the absolute freedom quickly follows. When, however, the freedom ceases to change back or relapse comes quickly, preceded only by a spell of warning silence. Today, when we met, she was somewhat constrained and bore all the signs of an internal struggle. I put it down myself to her making a valiant effort at the earliest instant she could do so. A very few minutes, however, gave her complete control of herself. Then, motioning her husband to sit beside her on the sofa where she was half reclining, she made the rest of us bring chairs up close. Taking her husband's hands in hers, she began. "We are all here together in freedom, for perhaps the last time. I know, dear. I know you will always be with me to the end." This was her husband, whose hand had, as we could see, tightened upon hers. "In the morning we go out upon our task, and God alone knows what may be stored for us. You are going to be so good to me as to take me with you. I know that all the brave, earnest men can do for poor, weak woman, and whose soul perhaps is lost. No, not yet, but is at any rate at stake. You will do. But you must remember that I am not as you are. There is poison in my blood, in my soul, which may destroy me, which must destroy me, unless some relief comes to us. Oh, my friends, you know as well as I do that my soul is at stake. And though I know there is one way out for me, you must not, and I must not take it." She looked appealingly to all of us in turn, beginning and ending with her husband. "What is that way?" asked Dr. Van Helsing in a hoarse voice. "What is that way which we must not, may not, take? That I may die now, either by my own hand or that of another, before the greater evil is entirely wrought. I know, and you know, that I, were I once dead, you could and would set free my immortal spirit, even as you did poor Lucy's. Were death or fear of death the only thing that stood in the way, I would not shrink to die here, now, amidst the friends who love me. But death is not all. I cannot believe that to die in such a case, when there is hope before us and a bitter task to be done, is God's will. Therefore, I, on my part, give up here the certainty of eternal rest, and go out into the dark where may be the blackest thing that the world or nether world holds." We were silent, for we knew instinctively that this was only a prelude. The faces of the others were set, and Harker's grew ashen gray. Perhaps he guessed better than any of us what was coming. She continued. "This is what I can give into the hatchpot." I could not but note the quaint legal phrase that she had used in such a place, with all seriousness. "What will each of you give? Your lives, I know," she went on quickly, "that is easy for brave men. Your lives are God's, and you can give them back to him. But what will you give to me?" She looked again, questioningly, but this time avoided her husband's face. Quincy seemed to understand. He nodded, and her face lit up. "Then I shall plainly tell you what I want, for there must be no doubtful matter in this connection between us now. You must promise me, once and for all, even you, my beloved husband, that should the time come, you will kill me.
What is that time?
The voice was Quincy's, but it was low and strained. When you shall be convinced that I am so changed, it is better that I die, that I may live. When I am thus dead in the flesh, then you will, without a moment's delay, drive a stake through me and cut off my head, or do whatever else may be wanting to give me rest. Quincy was the first to rise after the pause. He knelt down before her and, taking her hand in his, said solemnly,
I'm only a rough fellow who hasn't, perhaps, lived as a man should to win such distinction. But I swear to you, by all I hold sacred and dear, that should the time ever come, I shall not flinch from the duty you have set us. And I promise you, too, that I shall make all for certain, for if I am only doubtful, I shall take it that the time has come.
My true friend, was all she could say, amid her fast-falling tears, as bending over she kissed his hand. I swear the same, my dear Madam Mina, said Van Helsing.
And I, said Lord Godalming,
each of them in turn kneeling to her to take the oath. I followed, myself. Then her husband turned to her, wan-eyed and with a greenish pallor which subdued the snowy whiteness of his hair, and asked,
And must I, too, make such a promise, my wife?
You too, my dearest, she said, with infinite yearning of pity in her voice and eyes. You must not shrink. You are nearest and dearest in all the world to me. Our souls are knit into one, for all life and all time. Think, dear, that there have been times when brave men have killed their wives and their womankind to keep them from falling into the hands of the enemy. Their hands did not falter any the more because those that they loved implored them to slay them. It is men's duty towards those whom they love in such times of sore trial. And oh, my dear, if it is to be that I must meet death at any hand, let it be at the hand of him who loves me best. Dr. Van Helsing, I have not forgotten your mercy in poor Lucy's case to him who loved. She stopped with a flying blush and changed her phrase. To him who had best right to give her peace. If that time should come again, I look to you to make it a happy memory of my husband's life that it was his loving hand which set me free from the awful thrall upon me. Again, I swear, came the professor's resonant voice. Mrs. Harker smiled, positively smiled, as with a sigh of relief she leaned back and said, And now, one word of warning, a warning which you must never forget. This time, if it ever come, may come quickly and unexpectedly, and in such case you must lose no time in using your opportunity. At such a time I myself might be, nay, if the time ever comes, shall be, leagued with your enemy against you. One more request. She became very solemn as she said this. It is not vital and necessary like the others, but I want you to do one thing for me, if you will. We all acquiesced, but no one spoke. There was no need to speak. I want you to read the burial service. She was interrupted by a deep groan from her husband, taking his hand in hers, she held it over her heart and continued. You must read it over me some day. Whatever the issue may be of all this fearful state of things, it will be a sweet thought to all or some of us. You, my dearest, will, I hope, read it, for then it will be your voice in my memory forever, come what may. Oh, but my dear one, he pleaded, death is afar off from you. Nay, she said, holding up a warning hand, I am deeper in death in this moment than if the weight of an early grave lay heavy upon me. Oh, my wife, must I read it? He said, before he began. It would comfort me, my husband, was all she said. And he began to read when she had got the book ready. How can anyone tell of that strange scene? Its solemnity, its gloom, its sadness, its horror, and withal, its sweetness. Even a skeptic who can see nothing but a travesty of bitter truth in anything holy or emotional would have been melted to the heart had he seen that little group of loving and devoted friends kneeling around that stricken and sorrowing lady, or heard the tender passion of her husband's voice, as in tones so broken with emotion that often he had to pause, he read the simple and beautiful service for the burial of the dead.
I cannot go on. Words and voice fail me. She was right in her instinct. Strange as it all was, bizarre as it may hereafter seem even to us who felt its potent influence at the time, it comforted us much. And the silence which showed Mrs. Harker's coming relapse from the freedom of her soul did not seem so full of despair to any of us as we had dreaded. Jonathan Harker's Journal. 15th of October, Varna. We left Caring Cross on the morning of the 12th, got to Paris the same night, and took the places secured for us in the Orient Express. We traveled night and day, arriving here at about 5 o'clock. Lord Godalming went to the consulate to see if any telegram had arrived for him, whilst the rest of us came on to this hotel, the Odessus. The journey must have been, may have had incidents. I was, however, too eager to get on to care for them. Until the Tsarina Catherine comes into port, there will be no interest for me in anything in the wide world. Thank God, Mina is well, and looks to be getting stronger. Her color's getting back. She sleeps a great deal. Throughout the journey, she slept nearly all the time. Before sunrise and sunset, however, she's very wakeful and alert, and it has become a habit for Van Helsing to hypnotize her at such times. At first, some effort was needed, and he had to make many passes, but now she seems to yield at once, as if by habit, and scarcely any action is needed. He seems to have power at these particular moments to simply will, and her thoughts obey him. He always asks her if she can see and hear. She answers to the first, "Nothing. It is all dark." And to the second, "I can hear the waves lapping against the ship, and the water rushing by. Canvas and cordage strain, and masts and yards creak. The wind is high. I can hear it in the shrouds, and the bow throws back for the foam." It is evident that the Tsarina Catherine is still at sea, hastening on her way to Varna. Lord Godalming has just returned. He's had 4 telegrams, 1 each day since we started, and all to the same effect, that the Tsarina Catherine has not been reported to Lloyd's from anywhere. He's arranged before leaving London that his agent should send him a telegram every day saying if the ship had been reported. He was sure to have a message, even if she were not reported, so that he might be sure that there was a watch being kept at the other end of the wire. We had dinner and went to bed early. Tomorrow we are to see the vice consul and to arrange, if we can, about getting on board the ship as soon as she arrives. Van Helsing said that our chance will be to get on board before sunrise and sunset. The Count, even if he takes the form of a bat, cannot cross the running water of his own volition, and so cannot leave the ship. As he dare not change to man's form without suspicion, which he evidently wishes to avoid, he must remain in the box. If, then, we can come on board after sunrise, he is at our mercy. If we can open the box and make sure of him, as we did of poor Lucy, before he wakes, what mercy he shall get for us will not count for much. We think that we shall not have much trouble with officials or the seamen. Thank God, this is the country where bribery can do anything, and we are well supplied with money. We only have to make sure that the ship cannot come into port between sunrise and sunset without our being warned, and we shall be safe. Judge Moneybag will settle this case, I think. 16th of October. Mina's report still the same. Lapping waves, rushing water, darkness, and favoring winds. We are evidently in good time, and when we hear of the Tsarina Catherine, we shall be ready. As she must pass the Dardanelles, we are sure to have some report. 17th of October. Everything is pretty well fixed now, I think, to welcome the Count on his return from his tour. Godalming told the shippers that he fancied that the box sent aboard might contain something stolen from a friend of his, and got a half-consent that he might open it at his own risk. The owner gave him a paper telling the captain to give him every facility in doing whatever he chose on board the ship, and we also have a similar authorization from his agent at Varna. We've seen the agent, who was much impressed with Godalming's kindly manner to him, and we're all satisfied that whatever he can do to aid our wishes will be done. We've already arranged what we can do in case we get the box open. If the Count is there, Van Helsing and Seward will cut off his head at once and drive a stake through his heart. Morris and Godalming and I shall prevent interference, even if we have to use the arms, which we shall have ready. The professor says that if we can so treat the Count's body, it will soon fall after into dust. In such case, there would be no evidence against us. In any case, suspicion of murder were aroused. But even if it were not, we should stand or fall by our act, and perhaps someday this very script may be evidence to come between us and a rope. For myself, I should take the chance only too thankfully if it were to come. We mean to leave no stone unturned to carry out our intent. We have arranged with certain officials that the instant the Tsarina Catherine is seen, we are to be informed by a special messenger. 24th of October. A whole week of waiting. Daily telegrams to Godalming, but only the same story. Not yet reported. Mina's morning and evening hypnotic answer is unvaried. Lapping waves, rushing water, creaking masts. Rufus Smith, Lloyd's, London, to Lord Godalming, care of HBM, Vice Consul, Varna. Telegram, October 24th. Tsarina Catherine reported this morning from Dardanelles. Dr. Seward's diary, 25th of October. How I miss my phonograph. To write diary with a pen is irksome to me. But Van Helsing says I must. We were all wild with excitement yesterday when Godalming got his telegram from Lloyd's. I know now what men feel in battle when the call to action is heard. Mrs. Harker, alone of our party, did not show any signs of emotion. After all, it is not strange that she did not, for we took special care not to let her know anything about it, and we all tried to show not to show excitement when we were in her presence. In old days, she would, I'm sure, have noticed, no matter how we might have tried to conceal it. But in this way, she has greatly changed during the past 3 weeks. The lethargy grows upon her, and though she seems strong and well and is getting back some of her color, Van Helsing and I are not satisfied. We talk of her often. We have not, however, said a word to the others. It would break poor Jonathan's heart, certainly his nerve, if he knew that we even had a suspicion on the subject. Van Helsing examines, he tells me, her teeth very carefully while she's in the hypnotic condition, for he says that so long as they do not begin to sharpen, there is no active danger of a change in her. If this change would come, it'd be necessary to take steps. We both know what steps those would have to be, though we do not mention our thoughts to each other. We should neither of us shrink from the task, awful as it would be to contemplate. Euthanasia is an excellent and comforting word. I'm grateful to whoever invented it. It's only about 24 hours' sail from the Dardanelles to here at the rate the Tsarina Catherine has come to London. She should arrive sometime in the morning, but as she cannot possibly get in before then, we are all about to retire early. We shall get up to 1 o'clock as to be ready. 25th of October, noon. No news yet of the ship's arrival. Mrs. Harker's hypnotic report this morning was the same as usual, so it's possible that we may get news at any moment. We men are all in a fever excitement, except Harker, who's calm. His hands are as cold as ice, and an hour ago I found him whetting the edge of that great Gurkha knife which he always carries now with him. It will be a bad lookout for the Count if the edge of that kukri ever touches his throat, driven by that stern, ice-cold hand. Van Helsing and I were a little alarmed about Mrs. Harker today. About noon she got into a sort of lethargy which we did not like. Although we kept silence to the others, neither of us were happy about it. She had been restless all the morning, so that we were at first glad to know that she was sleeping. When, however, her husband mentioned casually that she was sleeping so soundly he could not wake her, we went to her room to see for ourselves. She was breathing naturally and looked so well and peaceful that we agreed that the sleep was better for her than anything else. Poor girl. She's had so much to forget that it's no wonder that sleep, if it brings oblivion to her, does her good. Later. Our opinion was justified, for when, after a refreshing sleep of some hours, she woke up, she seemed brighter and better than she had been for days. At sunset, she made the usual hypnotic report. Wherever he may be in the Black Sea, the Count is hurrying to his destination. To his doom, I trust. 26th of October. Another day and no tidings of the Tsarina Catherine. She ought to be here by now. That she is still journeying somewhere is apparent, for Mrs. Harker's hypnotic report at sunrise is still the same. It is possible that the vessel may be lying by at times for fog. Some of the steamers which came in last evening reported patches of fog in both the north and south of the port. We must continue our watching, as the ship may be signaled now at any moment. 27th of October, noon. Most strange. No use net yet of the ship we wait for. Mrs. Harker reported last night and this morning as usual, lapping waves, rushing water, though she added that the waves were very faint.
The telegrams from London have been more of the same. No further report. Van Helsing is terribly anxious, and told me just now that he fears the Count is escaping us. He added significantly, I do not like that lethargy of Madame Mina's. Soul and memories can do strange things during trance. I was about to ask him more, but Harker just then came in, and he held up a warning hand. We must try tonight at sunset to make her speak more fully when in her hypnotic state. 28th of October. Telegram. Rufus Smith, London, to Lord Godalming, care of HBM Vice Consul Varna. Tsarina Catherine reported entering Galatz at 1 o'clock today. Dr. Seward's diary. 28th of October. When the telegram came, announcing the arrival in Galatz, I did not think it was such a shock to any of us as might have been expected. True, we did not know whence or how or when the bolt would come, but I think we all expected that something strange would happen. The delay of arrival at Varna made us individually satisfied that things would not be as we expected. We only waited to learn when the change would occur. Nonetheless, however, was it a surprise. I suppose that nature works on such a hopeful basis that we believe against ourselves that things will be as they ought to be, not as we know they should be, or will be. Transcendentalism is a beacon for the angels, even if it be the will-o'-wisp to man. It was an odd experience, and we all took it differently. Van Helsing raised his hands over his head for a moment, as though in remonstrance with the Almighty, but he said not a word, and in a few seconds stood up with his face sternly set. Lord Godalming grew very pale, and sat breathing heavily. I was myself half stunned, and looked in wonder at one after the other. Quincy Morris tightened his belt with that quick movement that I know so well. In our wandering days it meant action. Mrs. Harker grew ghastly white so that the scar on her forehead seemed to burn, but she folded her hands meekly and looked up in prayer. Harker smiled. Actually smiled. The dark, bitter smile of one who's without hope. But at the same time his action belied his words, for his hands instinctively sought the hilt of that great kukri knife and rested there. When does the next train start for Galatz? Said Van Helsing to us, generally. At 6:30 tomorrow morning. We all stared, for the answer came from Mrs. Harker. How on earth do you know? Said Art. You forget, or perhaps you do not know, that Jonathan does, and so does Dr. Van Helsing, that I am the train fiend. At home in Exeter, I always used to make up the timetables so as to be helpful to my husband. I found it so useful sometimes that I always make a study of the timetables now. I knew that if anything were to take us to Castle Dracula, we should go by Galatz, or at any rate through Bucharest, so I learned the times very carefully. Unhappily, there are not many to learn, as the only train tomorrow leaves, as I say. Wonderful woman, murmured the professor. Can't we get a special? Asked Lord Godalming. Van Helsing shook his head. I fear not. This land is very different from yours or mine. Even if we did have a special, it would probably not arrive so soon as our regular train. Moreover, we have something to prepare. We must think. Now, let us organize. You, friend Arthur, go to the train and get the tickets and arrange that all be ready for us to go in the morning. Do you, friend Jonathan, go with the agent of the ship and get from him letters to the agent in Galatz with authority to make search the ship, just as it was here. Morris Quincy, you see the vice consul, get his aid with his fellow in Galatz, and do all that he can to make our way smooth so that no times be lost when over the Danube. John will stay with Madame Mina and me, and we shall consult. For if time be long, you may be delayed, and it will not matter when the sun set, for I am here with Madame to make report. And I, said Mrs. Harker brightly, and more like her old self than she'd been in many a long day, shall try to be of use in all ways, and shall think and write for you as I used to do. Something is shifting in me in some strange way, and I feel freer than I have been at late. The three younger men looked happier at the moment as they seemed to realize the significance of her words, but Dr. Van Helsing and I, turning to each other, met with a grave and troubled glance. We said nothing of the time, however. When the three men had gone out to their tasks, Van Helsing asked Mrs. Harker to look up the copy of the diaries and to find him the part of Jonathan's journal at the castle. She went away with it, and when the door was shut upon her, he said to me, "We mean the same. Speak out. There is some change. It is a hope that makes me sick, for it may quite deceive us." "Quite so,"
Do you know why I asked her to get me the manuscript?
No, said I, unless it was to get an opportunity of seeing me alone.
You are in part right, friend John, but only in part. I want to tell you something. And oh, my friend, I am taking a great, a terrible risk, but I believe it is right. In the moment when Madame Mina said those words that arrest both our understanding, an inspiration came to me. In the trance of 3 days ago, the Count sent her his spirit to read her mind, or more like, he took her to see him in his earth box in that ship, with water rushing, just as it go free at rise and set of sun. He learned then that we are here, for she have more to tell in her open life, with eyes to see and ears to hear than he, shut as he is in his coffin box. Now he can make his most effort to escape us. At present, he want her not. He is sure, with his so great knowledge, that she will come to his call. But he cut her off. Take her, as he can do, out of his own power, that she so she not come to him. Ah, there I have hope that our man-brains that have been of man so long, and that have not lost the grace of God, will come higher than his child-brain that lie in his tomb for centuries, that grow not yet to our stature, and that do only work selfish and therefore small. Here comes Madame Mina, not a word to her of her trance. She know it not, and it would overwhelm her and make despair just when we want her hope, all her courage, when most we want all her great brain, which is trained like man's brain, but is of sweet woman, and have a special power which the Count gave her, and which he may not altogether take away, though he think not so. Hush, let me speak, and you shall learn. Oh, John, my friend, we are in awful straits. I fear, as I've never feared before. We can only trust the good God. Silence. Here she comes. I thought that the professor was going to break down and have hysterics, just like he had when Lucy died. But with a great effort, he controlled himself and was at perfect nervous poise when Mrs. Harker tripped into the room, bright and happy-looking and in the doing of the work, seemingly forgetful of her misery. As she came in, she handed a number of sheets of typewriting to Van Helsing. He looked over them gravely, his face brightening up as he read. Then, holding the pages between his finger and thumb, he said, "Friend John, to you with so much of experience already, and you too, dear Madame Mina, that are young, here is a lesson. Do not fear ever to think. A half-thought has been buzzing often in my brain, but I fear to let him loose his wings. Here now, with more knowledge, I go back to where that half-thought came from, and I find that he be no half-thought at all, that be whole-thought, though so young he is not yet strong to use his little wings. Nay, like the ugly duck of my friend Hans Andersen, he be no duck-thought at all, but a big swan thought that sail nobly on big wings, when the time is come for him to try them. See, I read here what Jonathan have written. That other of his race who, in a later age, again and again, brought his forces over the great river into Turkey-land, who, when he was beaten back, come again and again and again, though he had to come alone from the bloody field where his troops were being slaughtered, since he knew that alone he could ultimately triumph. What does this tell us? Not much? No. The Count's child thought see nothing, therefore he speaks so free. Your man thought see nothing, my man thought see nothing, till just now. No. But there comes another word from whom someone might speak without thought, because she, too, know not what it mean, what it might mean. Just as there are elements which rest, yet when in nature's course they move on their way and they touch, then poof, and there comes a flash of light, heavens wide, that blind and kill and destroy some, but that show up all earth before below for leagues and leagues, is it not so? Well, I shall explain. To begin, have you ever studied the philosophy of crime? Yes and no. You, John, yes, it is for a study of insanity. You, no, Madame Mina, for crime touch you not but once. Still, your mind works true, and argues not a particulari ad universale. There is this peculiarity in criminals. It is so constant in all centuries and at all times that even police, who know not much from philosophy, come to know empirically that it is to be empiric. The criminal always work at one crime. That is the true criminal, who seems predestinate to crime, and who will of none other. The criminal has not full man brain. He is clever and cunning and resourceful, but he be not of man's stature as to brain.
He be of child brain in much. Now this criminal of ours is predestinate to crime also. He too have child brain, and it is of the child to do what he have done. The little bird, the little fish, the little animal learn not by principle, but empirically. And when he learn to do, then there is to him the ground to start from to do more. Dos posto, said Archimedes, give me the fulcrum, and I shall move the world. To do this once is the fulcrum whereby child brain become man brain. And until he have the purpose to do more, he continue to do that same again every time, just as he have done before. Oh, my dear, I see that your eyes are opened, and that to you the lightning flash show for all the leagues. For Mrs. Harker began to clap her hands, and her eyes sparkled. He went on. Now you shall speak. Tell us two dry men of science what you see with those so bright eyes. He took her hand and held it whilst she spoke. His finger and thumb closed on her pulse, and I thought instinctively and unconsciously as she spoke. The Count is a criminal of a criminal type. Nordo and Lombroso would so classify him, and qua criminal he is of imperfectly formed mind. Thus, in a difficulty, he has to seek resource in habit. His past is a clue, and the one page of it that we know, and that from his own lips tells us that once before, when in what Mr. Morris would call a tight place, he went back to his own country from the land he tried to invade, and thence, without losing purpose, prepared himself for a new effort. He came again, better equipped for his work, and won. So he came to London, to invade a new land. He was beaten, and when all hope of success was lost and his existence in danger, he fled back over the sea to his home, just as formerly he had fled back over the Danube from Turkeyland. "Good, good, you so clever lady," said Van Helsing enthusiastically as he stooped and kissed her hand. A moment later, he said to me, as calmly as though we had been having a sick-room consultation, 72 only, and in all this excitement, I have hope." Turning to her again, he said with keen expectation, "But go on, go on. There is more to tell, if you will. Be not afraid. John and I know. I do, in any case, and shall tell you if you are right. Speak, without fear." "I will try to, but you will forgive me if I seem egotistical." "Nay, fear not. You may be egotist, for it is of you that we think." "Then, as he is criminal, he is selfish, and as his intellect is small and his action based on selfishness, he confines himself to one purpose. That purpose is remorseless. As he fled back over the Danube, leaving his forces to be cut to pieces, so now he is intent on being safe, careless of all. So his own selfishness frees my soul somewhat of the terrible power which he acquired over me on that dreadful night. I felt it. Oh, I felt it. Thank God for his great mercy. My soul is freer than it's been since that awful hour, and all that haunts me is a fear lest in some dream or trance he may have used my knowledge for his ends." The professor stood up. "He has so used your mind, and by it he has left us here in Varna, whilst the ship that carried him rushed through enveloping fog up to Galatz, where doubtless he had made preparation for escaping from us. But his child mind only saw so far, and it may be that, as ever in God's providence, the very thing that the evildoer most reckoned on for his selfish good turns out to be his chiefest harm. The hunter is taken in his own snare, as the great psalmist says. For now that he thinks he is free from every trace of us all, and that he has escaped us with so many hours to him, then his selfish child brain will whisper him to sleep. He think, too, that as he cut himself off from knowing your mind, there can be no knowledge of him to you. This is where he fail. That terrible baptism of blood which he give you make you free to go to him in spirit, just as you have yet done in your times of freedom, when the sun rise and set. At such times you go by my volition, and not his, this power to good of you and others. You've won from your suffering at his hands. This is now all the more precious that he know it not, and to guard himself have even cut himself off from his knowledge of our where. We, however, are not all selfish, and we believe that God is with us through all this blackness and these many dark hours. We shall follow him, and we shall not flinch, even if we peril ourselves that we do become like him. Friend John, this has been a great hour, and it have done much to advance us on our way. You must scribe and write him all down, so that when the others return from our work, you can give it to them, for they shall know as we do. And so, I have written it whilst we wait for their return. and Mrs. Harker has written with her typewriter all that she has since brought the MS to us. This has been Rachel Reading Bookshelf with part 14 of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Have a wonderful day.